Too often, what we hear about Africa comes only from the news, and it's negative news at that. In reality, Africa is worthy of discussion on so many other levels. The purpose of this podcast is just to present some interesting information about the continent to listeners of all backgrounds and hopefully stoke further curiosity to learn more. This podcast is really just two friends who love international relations and history chatting about Africa. My name is Lane Munir, and I'm a research fellow at George Mason University Korea in the School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution. I have my PhD from New York University, and my research focuses on gender and conflict in Africa. Last year, the stars aligned to allow me to become great friends with another global relations enthusiast, Ashika Clare. And now we spend a lot of time talking about world politics.
I guess this is where I introduce myself. Well, my resume is not as yet impressive as Ms. Munir's, but I'm a first-year PhD student studying poli-sci at the University of Notre Dame, and I'm also a citizen of the Bahamas, which is a small group of islands off the coast of Florida. 92.7% of the population is Black, and I am one of those Black citizens. We're a former British colony, so I recognize that my ancestors came from Africa. However, I've never been to Africa. I've only heard about it in the news or actually just nature documentaries. But when Lane and I get together, I'm so curious about her history because I know she went to Nigeria and so many other countries and she spent time there. So I like to know about life there, society, politics. I'm curious as a social scientist, but then also as a descendant of the country. The continent. Africa is not a country.
Please.
That is a misconception.
Yes, and African is not a language.
And it is not a language either. I know most people think so, but it's not a fact. And that's why we have this podcast to get rid of that ignorance and also mine as well. So, but then Lane is not just all the things she listed before. She's also a budding, aspiring author. She's writing a book that's going to be based in Nigeria. So I hope you guys are looking forward to that. It's going to be fantastic. But that's essentially why Lane and I are having this podcast, so we can talk about what we usually talk about, but this time with an audience.
So to sum it up, we're just two nerds nerding out on international relations, and we talk a lot about Africa. So this is what we're recording.
Yes, I'm going to just pepper Lane with some questions, and I think we should just start with the big ones and see where we go from there. The first question I have for Lane is, how did slavery work?
Oh, you're going big.
I'm gonna go big, Lane. Like I now live as a descendant of Africa. I now live across the ocean, and I'm like, I don't think this is how I was supposed to be here, but I think slavery got me there. So tell me, how did slavery work?
Okay. Oh man, I thought we were gonna have like some sort of an intro or something. So let me just start with, okay, so I think I was attracted initially to the study of the transatlantic slave trade because it's part of, I think, a general trend of Africa being what I would call like the land of superlatives, right? So there's never been any institutionalized slavery that covered so many miles, was so expansive, lasted so long, and displaced and traumatized such a large number of people. But like, that's just part of Africa as a whole, just being a land of extremes. And I mean that both positively and negatively. So the longer I study Africa, the more I realize I know nothing. And I get even more confused. And when I say Africa, I mean sub-Saharan Africa. I've spent a lot of time in North Africa, but I know very little about North Africa. So I mean Africa south of Sahara. So it is the most, it is the least, it is the worst, it is the best, it is the cradle of civilization. Africa as a whole has 54 countries officially, plus Western Sahara and Somaliland and some disputed territories. I mean, Africa covers 20% of Earth's land surface.
It's quite a bit.
It's quite a bit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's just an example. And then, so you asked about slavery, and that just makes me think about the extremes of the continent. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing to clear up is that when Western, most of the world, especially Westerners, talks about quote unquote the slave trade, what we really mean is the transatlantic slave trade, mm-hmm. which was essentially the triangle between Western Africa. Most slaves came from what's now Nigeria and now Senegal and now a little less Senegal and more Ghana.
Okay.
And then slaves were sent to the Western Hemisphere, and then raw goods that the slaves produced were sent to Europe. The raw goods were turned into manufactured goods, which were then sent back to Africa, often to curry favor of chiefs and to get more slaves. Oh. So it created this triangle. So we refer to the transatlantic slave trade, but there's also an eastern slave trade that went from eastern Africa, mm-hmm. notably Kenya and Tanzania, to the Middle East.
I see.
And the East Atlantic slave trade predates the transatlantic slave trade, or sorry, the eastern African slave trade. Predates it, and it lasted much longer, but the number of slaves per year that were shipped to the Middle East were far less.
So you're saying that slavery was in Africa even before the Europeans got there?
Yes, but I really need to clarify that it was not the chattel and chain, murderous, destroy a person's soul and culture sort of slavery that we saw in the Americas. Mm-hmm. For example, when you had slavery within Africa and you had slaves sent to the Middle East, oftentimes those slaves, it was more like a form of like feudalism or indentured servitude oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And those slaves could marry and they could produce children and they could sometimes live with their families and they had hope of earning their way out of slavery. So I hesitate to compare the nature of the two trades because they really were quite different.
Okay.
Transatlantic slave trade was far more destructive. In fact, the Eastern slave trade lasted so long that even like Middle Eastern emirs brought their African slaves to Queen Elizabeth's coronation in the early 1950s.
Whoa.
So they were no longer engaging in slave trade, but there were still descendants of slaves that were still being utilized in the Middle East by royalty.
Were they employed or they were just almost like on the level of, you know...
I would call it indentured servitude, like you often saw in Middle Eastern Europe or something like that.
Yeah.
And the major base in the East Africa was Kenya, specifically the main island of Zanzibar, which is now off Tanzania. That was the main exchange port where all slaves from Eastern Africa went through to get to the Middle East.
Okay. So that's how the slave trade worked.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's the two of them.
Okay.
I think you're asking about the transatlantic slave trade.
Yeah.
Right?
That's. Okay. I think that's how I got to the Bahamas. I'm just very curious.
That is how your ancestors got to the Bahamas. Yeah. In total, I learned in Ghana that 12 million Africans total were kidnapped and sold during all of the transatlantic slave trade, and obviously we know about the terrible things that happened on boats. And actually the thing that I actually learned in Cape Coast in Ghana, mm-hmm. when I toured, former, slave holding castles, was that only about 5% of all slaves went to the U.S. A minority of slaves went to the U.S. actually. We think of slavery as an American institution, but Brazil received by far the most slaves, like
good.
Up to like between 30% and 40% of all slaves from Western Africa went to Brazil.
Why?
Because they had lots and lots of agricultural land, which is also why Brazil now has the largest mixed race population.
Mm.
So Brazil was the major receiver. And then a third went to the Caribbean, such mm-hmm. as your island of the Bahamas. And then a third, quote unquote, went elsewhere. And that elsewhere includes the United States.
Can I assume that the reason why when we think of slavery, we think of, you know, the American form of slavery, was it more brutal or was it just Hollywood? That's why when we think slavery, we think transatlantic and we think slaves on American plantations.
I hesitate to compare the brutality in each region because I think they all were maybe easier or more brutal in their own ways. I will say that American slavery was very well recorded,
mm.
very well codified in law.
Okay.
And so we have very clear records of it that probably don't exist when slaves were being exploited more informally in less developed countries. That would be my answer.
Okay. Wow. That statistic about Brazil was really most surprising to me. But if we sort of were to look at, now that we know Africa's history with slavery, and we look at Africa itself and how it identifies and just how it identifies itself, how much of the cultural identity of African culture is nationalism, where it's based on borders drawn by the colonizers? I hope you've watched Wakanda, film The Colonizers. And how much is ethnic and tribal associations? Because I have African friends, and they would ask me, what's my tribe? And I'm like, tribe, I'm a Bahamian. So I know there are different ways of identifying yourself.
Yeah, that's really important, actually. And when you study conflict, it's particularly important. I feel very confident saying that ethnic identity is by far stronger than any sense of nationalism.
Okay.
And this really makes sense, right? Nationalism is kind of artificial. It's based on borders drawn by Europeans to benefit Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas ethnicity is tradition and it's family and it's timeless. Even though in reality, a lot of tribal divisions were stoked by Europeans and exaggerated to further the divide and conquer sort of rule that they engaged in. For example, Belgians in Central Africa really exaggerated the difference between Hutus and Tutsis, which ended up leaving, some argued, to the Rwandan Civil War. But anyway, ethnicity is by far stronger than nationalism. And nationalism is constituted by ethnic identity and ethnic tensions. So there's very few, I would say, certainly in West Africa, very few politicians who don't poke at ethnic identity as a form of like shoring up their political platform. I would say, I feel, based on my observations in West Africa, East Africa, you are your tribe first and your nationality second. And I think it's that tribalism has a much greater enforcement mechanism, mm-hmm. because you live among your tribesmen. You walk down the street with them. You trade with them. Your children marry them. You marry them. And so you have a lot of explaining to do if you go against tribal interests.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have so much explaining to do if you go against national interest or you disagree with somebody about who should be in parliament or something like that. So tribal identity first and nationalism second.
So if an African from one country meets an African from another country, mm-hmm. would they ask their tribe or would they ask their nationality? Is this something that is within country or between countries, this idea of nationalism versus tribalism? If someone from West Africa met someone from one of the more southern states, would they say, what is your tribe? Or do they judge them based on what is your nationality?
This is just an educated guess. Because so many tribes spill over into other countries, right? Mm-hmm. So you have Igbos both in Nigeria and in Cameroon. You have Hausas that spill out way across West Africa. I will say if two strangers met in the Sahara,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they are both Fulani, which are the herding tribe that covers most of the Sahara, they would feel great kinship because they're both Fulani. If they were of different tribes and one was from Nigeria and one was from Mali, they would feel no kinship whatsoever.
Mm.
So my answer would be if the countries are related either by Islam or religion or they share a border, you would certainly ask about their tribe. If the countries are very geographically separated, you might rely more on nationalism because you have no link with each other.
Okay. Can you argue that if there was a greater lean towards nationalism, that would lead to more internal harmony? Or is it better to say that the tribalism itself is what actually keeps the country together?
You just asked the most enduring question that is like basically defined what is an African since independence. So the golden age of independence, the golden year was 1960, mm-hmm. especially for West Africa. And so there was this call to nationalism, and the idea was that nationalism would help the diversity of African populations to overcome ethnic tensions, and nationalism was the remedy
mm-hmm.
to all of these ethnic tensions.
It's rare that nationalism is a remedy for much of anything.
For much of anything.
If you especially look at European history, so Africa is sort of like trying to change the model.
And I don't think anybody would argue that that's clearly not working, mm-hmm. right? So you just ask a question that nobody can answer, and I don't know if there is an answer to that.
Okay, I'm glad I asked then. So we've been talking about how Africa is obviously separated into different countries for different reasons. So obviously they may speak different languages as well. What are the linguistic things that you found interesting in Africa?
Oh, sometimes I wish if I could go back in time, I wish I'd actually been a linguist and focused on Africa. Part of the reason is that so many beautiful and obscure African languages are dying, which kind of makes my heart hurt.
Do you know why they're dying? Like, what's the cause of
urbanization? People moving from rural areas to urban areas to get jobs.
Okay,
is the primary component, and just the general forces of globalization. So the spread of like nationalism calls for a unified language. So the spreading of through media, newspapers, and things like that of whatever the dominant language is. And just older and also increased literacy and increased access to public education. Again, you have to almost by definition marginalize obscure indigenous languages to be able to teach a classroom full of children in a single language. So I don't want to pass a moral judgment, but it does make my heart hurt to think about languages disappearing. So one of the things I have to clarify with people, because I studied Igbo in Nigeria for a year, and when I was in the Peace Corps in Mozambique, I learned a little bit of my local language there, which was Shopi, is that there are over 2,000 languages in Africa. There's over 500 languages in Nigeria alone.
Wow.
Some people call those dialects, but Africa's the most linguistically diverse area on the planet, which, I mean, this makes sense since it's the cradle of human civilization. There's been the most time for languages to evolve and diverge there. So that's like a general overview. I think one of the things that I learned in Africa that I've taken with me back to the US, I'm American as an aside, is and I notice it all the and I notice it and I think about it and I'm so fascinated by it. I think it was Steven Pinker's book, The Language Instinct. Mm-hmm. He has a section on BEV, B-E-V, which is Black English Vernacular.
Okay.
We used to call that Ebonics. We don't use that word anymore.
We do not.
The linguists, you call it Black English Vernacular.
Okay.
It is a standalone, valid, well-structured dialect or language of English on its own. It is not a bastardization of English.
Okay.
And linguists have found this is because it shares a linguistic structure with Yoruba, one of the top, Yoruba and Hausa are the two dominant languages of Nigeria, and Yorubas were one of the largest populations that were traded for slavery during the transatlantic slave trade. And so Black English Vernacular and Yoruba share the same structure. And so that's part of the explanation for why Black English Vernacular is not wrong English. It's actually a Creole language.
Okay.
Because it evolved from early slaves trying to learn English through the lens of Yoruba. So ever since I started thinking about the relationship between like slaves leaving Africa and the way that languages evolve elsewhere, I'm fascinated by language patterns. When I went to the Bahamas,
yes,
I go anywhere in the Caribbean, you hear any sort of Creole. It has made every form of language that I've heard in the Western Hemisphere so much richer because I can try to think about how it's related to indigenous African languages.
Okay. So, wow, 5,000 languages within Africa.
2,000.
Okay, 2,000 within Africa. So there are many languages that they speak. I'm going to refer to them as native languages. However, when we recognize that Africans speak everything also from English to Portuguese to French, you then begin to wonder why are languages where they are within Africa? Why are some countries the predominant language is English and other countries the predominant language is French? What accounts for that?
That's a good question. What you're really asking is why did some countries get colonized by some European powers and other countries colonized by others, right?
Exactly that.
So the big players in Africa are the British and the French, and then you have lesser players in Africa, the Portuguese, the Germans had some territories, the Spanish had some territories, the Belgians had territories in Central Africa, etc. And the best explanation I can give you in a nutshell is that the European powers were racing to colonize different parts of Africa as fast as possible. And so the Spanish mm-hmm. beat everyone else to the Western Hemisphere.
Okay.
So they were firmly entrenched in the colonial project in the Western Hemisphere, so they had no time or resources or manpower to really make inroads in Africa, which is why there's only one Hispanophone Spanish-speaking country in Africa, which is Equatorial Guinea.
Really?
Which I tried to enter by boat and was awkwardly detained for an entire afternoon. It was quite nerve-wracking, and was told that I was not allowed to enter the country.
Oh, that will be an interesting story for another podcast.
Sorry. So the Spanish already had their hands. They were already occupied in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay.
The Portuguese were pretty heavily invested in Brazil, which is why they only ended up getting five countries. It's called Lusophone, is Portuguese speaking in Africa.
Okay.
They're five tiny countries that don't have a lot, except Angola has its oil. But the French, because they weren't so successful in the Western Hemisphere, and the British were less successful than the Spanish, they had much more resources to put into Africa.
Oh, that makes sense.
So it was like a competition between who would get the Western Hemisphere and who would get Africa. So, and it was just, and I really also want to clarify, the Spanish in the Western Hemisphere invested more. Mm-hmm. They built hospitals and churches, and they intermarried with the local population. Whereas Europeans in Africa were just extractive. It was about getting natural resources and spending as little money as possible there, like pure profit.
Why was that?
Well, Africa was seen as nothing but pure natural resources, whereas the Western Hemisphere was more about spreading the Catholic word of God and getting converts to Catholicism.
Do you think if it were switched and the Portuguese and the Spanish decided, let's focus on Africa, and the other countries had landed in the West first, that we would now, Africa would be a country of more converts as opposed to the extractive practices? And because I didn't even know that they had arrived in that fashion to determine what they did, but it makes you think if things had switched.
It's hard because you can't, the thing with history is you don't have your counterfactual, right? You don't know. There's a great book called What If, which explores what would happen in history if things happened differently. I'm inclined to think that the geographic realities and the tribal realities of Africa would never have allowed it, right? Because South America comparably is more developed than Africa. There's so many challenges to Africa that are inherent to Africa. I don't think, it's too hard for me to know. That's my answer.
So
it's a good question.
What you were referring to before, how you said there was a race for mm-hmm. countries in Africa, mm-hmm. I believe that's sort of known as the scramble for Africa.
Yeah, oh, you okay? So you know that?
I'm somewhat familiar with the term. Can you give me a bit more information as to how that happened, how that took place, how were they racing against each other?
Okay, and the scramble for Africa is important to language because that's what solidified what the dominant language was of each colony. So okay, scramble for Africa in a nutshell. So there's, I think, like seven key colonizers in African history. And in my opinion, if you study the nature of their rule,
mm-hmm.
there's kind of a hierarchy to who was the most exploitative and who mm-hmm. was comparably less exploitative, which is not saying anything,
basically,
right?
Basically less worse.
Less terrible. Right, right. Absolutely. So if you study a lot of African history, Belgians are considered the bloodiest. Yeah, in terms of their use of mutilations and murder and forced slavery and like amputating people as a form of punishment to teach them to behave. Belgians, King Leopold, it's considered like the most brutal.
See, that's really interesting for me to hear because when I think of Belgium, right? I'm thinking of it as the Belgium now, cosmopolitan.
And a human rights hub.
Exactly. And so I would not think that their history would be like that. But we only think of countries as they present themselves now. But when you think historically, yeah, Belgium was
150 years ago. That is the last colonizer you wanted if you were an African.
Okay, so I'm feeling a bit more appreciative of the British. I didn't think I'd be in that position.
Right. Pretty rough colonizers were the Portuguese, the Dutch, who also, I mean,
exactly, the Netherlands. No one thinks, oh, the Netherlands, there goes the mutilators.
It's where The Hague is, where you prosecute people for human rights violations, right?
Well, if there's anything, it seems they've really turned themselves around then.
Absolutely. The Germans, they occupied what's now Togo. They weren't ever strong enough there to like really have the hold that other countries were. The French were brutal in the sense that they had their own legal system called the indigenat, which gave French colonial administrators the right to murder any African on site without any proof for crimes committed against the crown or whatever you want to call it. Spain, when it was there, was, I guess, comparably a little bit easier. And then you had the British. The only reason you would ever like think that the British are maybe less brutal is they did a lot of missionary work and they built a lot of schools. So they did do a little bit more in terms of like building an educational infrastructure.
So everything is about to whom you're being compared.
Exactly. Yeah. Please. I don't want to be like a colonization apologist. And I also say that because the British were comparably hands off. Mm-hmm. So they engaged in what's considered indirect rule. So they would bribe local chiefs and they would do this to maintain pre-existing structures of indigenous rule. Mm-hmm. So they were also a little bit like less disruptive.
Okay.
France, however, took a more top-down approach and it centralized its governments in Africa using officials from France that it sent to Africa, and it totally ousted local rulers and imposed that legal system that I called the indigenats. So, sorry, to get to your question about the scramble for Africa. So let's step back. It's the early 1880s and Europeans only have a secure rule over like 10% of Africa in the early 1880s. So they get together at an event called the Berlin Conference, which was in 1884, and they just carve up the continent because they're fighting over it down there, and they realize they're wasting resources fighting each other that they could be using to exploit. So within 30 years of the scramble for the Berlin Conference, essentially the entire continent is ruled except for Libya, Ethiopia, and part of Somalia. And then obviously Liberia, because Liberia is a U.S. protectorate that was actually founded for slaves to return to Africa. Mm-hmm. And this carving really started over disputes in Egypt and the Congo. Those were like the two hot spots of what led to the general movement to really draw borders in Africa for Europeans. And then these territories, once they were carved up, were used as, I guess, political playing cards to settle disputes all over the world. Like, for example, the Panama Canal. So if I was France and you were Holland or whatever, and we had a dispute, I would say, okay, I'll give you this part of Africa if you give me that part of Africa. Wow. And they were used as political capital. Of course, obviously to the victimization of the population that lived there. So like, as an example, after World War I, Germany's holdings in Africa were divided between Britain and France, which is why there's English-speaking and French-speaking Cameroon today. So the part of Cameroon that borders Nigeria is English-speaking, and they're actually having an insurgency there.
I see.
Of English speakers versus the majority of French speakers. But that conflict only exists because Germany lost everything after World War II. So that's what I mean when I say that they were like traded as political capital.
That is so presumptuous.
I know.
That is so, I mean, I'm just, yeah. That you'd sit in your country thousands of miles away and decide what to do with other people's homes. Okay, so I guess the next question is, after we've been discussing how horrible colonization is,
yes.
How did it end? How did it finally cut?
Sorry, that's a great question. That's why I'm exhaling.
Yes, like, yes, we are both exhaling. I'm glad it finally came to an end. But how did it?
It was not abrupt. It was a slow process. It fell out of favor slowly. And I would describe it as a confluence of factors that happened simultaneously. So World War II really depleted European resources.
Oh, that's one good thing that came out of the war then.
Right. You obviously, if you're Germany, you can't run your colony if your cities have been destroyed. And, you know, if you're allied countries, you have to put your money into the war. Mm-hmm. So World War II depleted European resources. And then I think most people don't know that African soldiers were conscripted to fight on the side of their colonizers.
So they'll die for the people who are making their lives miserable.
Yes. So you had the conscription of African soldiers, and it was also in the African soldiers' best interest, because if they served in the war, they could come back and be offered educational opportunities, positions as civil servants. So it was a way of upward social mobility.
Did you say back to their own country or back to the country?
Back to Africa.
Europe?
So okay. The offer for a lot of Africans was you go fight on the side of your European colonizer. When after the war you come back, we'll give you a position as a civil servant, we'll send you to university. It was a way for upward social mobility.
Did they live up to that promise? Did they actually do these things?
Well, they didn't. I think in some instances, yes, but they didn't have to keep the promise very long, right? So World War II ended in 1945, and then the golden year of independence was 1960, so they didn't have to uphold the promise very long.
Okay.
But what happened when you had African soldiers going and fighting on behalf of Europeans is it gave them a consciousness after they returned home, because they had been fighting alongside Europeans.
Yes.
And it totally changed their sense of like their racial identity and the hierarchy that they had experience for generations with European colonizers. So then that leads to, not coincidentally, you have the Pan-African Congress in 1945, the last year of World War II. And then, of course, you also know that the U.S. under Roosevelt lobbied really hard for decolonization.
Why is that? Why were the Americans all of a sudden very interested in ending colonization?
Because it was a means of weakening European competitors.
I had a feeling. I'm like, I'm not feeling natural altruism emerging here. I felt that it has to be for some sort of strategic purpose. So if it ends, then this is a means of weakening them because we're taking away their resources.
Absolutely. So it benefited the U.S.
Yes, it did.
So for the European colonizers that kept their promise of giving upward social mobility to Africans who had fought, they did this because they thought having colonial subjects who were part of the colonial project would shore up European power.
Mm-hmm.
And so they educated Africans back in Europe, but all this did was it turned around to bite them, because then these educated Africans who had the support of the U.S. came to understand that their rule wasn't right. And so actually that little project to try to like get Africans to be part of a colonial project is actually what undid the colonial project.
That's so interesting. What I'm thinking of, like in America, they, when they had slaves, they went out of their way to make sure the slaves did not learn, because they said this would be turned on us. And the Europeans said, let's help them to learn, because then they'll automatically want to be our allies.
But only because they were at a point where they had to, because it was 1945. They didn't have extra Europeans to keep in Africa to rule it. So the idea was, let's train Africans to rule other Africans on our behalf.
Desperate times.
Yeah, exactly. Desperate times. And so this is also why this change in African consciousness is why you have the spread of socialism in Africa, which often isn't talked about. And you have these really powerful socialist leaders like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. You had a socialism spread throughout Mozambique. And I would also add that at least in the case of Nigeria, the discovery of oil there in 1958, right, which is just in the decade following the end of World War II, was very empowering. Yes, because it made Nigerians confident that they could financially sustain themselves without European colonization, that they could be independent.
Okay.
So you had all this. So the Europeans are weakened.
Mm-hmm.
You have more educated Africans who have a consciousness about their status coming back from war. And then you have the discovery of natural resources in some African countries. So these things all come together to make Africans much more confident about their ability to govern themselves.
So all of these things added up to the end of colonization. But there's one thing I want to sort of pluck out there when you say the discovery or the use of natural resources. That has certainly taken a turn for the worse if we look in recent years, what's known as the oil curse.
The oil curse, the paradox of plenty is also a term that's like pretty common.
How does that work?
Okay, so sorry, I have like a whole chapter on this, so I have to step back. Okay, so let me first start with a really important idea that I heard my first year of my PhD from a professor from Benin, Leonard Wanchukwu, and he said, the purpose of democracy is to curb bad behavior.
That's what we hope.
That's what we'd hope, right? So we tend to think of democracy positively.
Yes.
So it means we get to vote. It means we get to assemble in groups. It means we get to write letters. But really the reason it was developed was to stop corruption, to stop nepotism and things like that. So that means that when democracy is firmly entrenched mm-hmm. before the discovery of oil,
okay.
it stops oil-related problems. A good example of a country that has tons of oil and handled it really well because it was a strong democratic country beforehand is Norway.
I was thinking the same thing. Yes, they do seem to have a wonderful model as to how to let the whole country rise.
Absolutely. Canada is an example of that. I mean, to a lesser extent, the U.S., right?
Yeah.
So, however, the problem becomes in Africa, you didn't have that. You have the discovery of oil and all of this wealth
mm-hmm.
before democracy is firmly instilled to stop all of the corruption and bad behavior that all of that wealth can entail. And so the paradox of plenty, or the oil curse, as you called it, it encourages, it's problematic on so many levels, which is why I really try to encourage people to not applaud when you hear about a new oil reserve or a new gold mine in a developing country, because it can be really problematic. It can be worse than not having the natural resource at all. So what a mono economy, an economy based on one natural resource, does is it encourages the atrophy of every other sector that's not based on that natural resource.
Mm.
So basically countries put all of their economic eggs in one basket, so to speak, which is bad.
Which is always a bad thing to do.
As a person, you want to diversify your financial portfolio.
You never know what would happen.
As a country, you want to do the exact same thing. And it's also dangerous because by definition, the volatility in world oil prices coupled with domestic inflation, it makes long-term planning very difficult because you don't know what your natural resource is going to be worth. So as an example, the oil boom of the 1970s, it left Nigerians with all of these half-finished public projects well into the 1980s. And with like oil in Nigeria, for example, the benefits of a good year are pretty short-lived,
mm-hmm.
while the negative effects of a bad year endure. And this volatility in the profitability of a natural resource, it encourages coups and what political scientists call capturing of the state,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know how long this wealth is going to be here. I want a carpe diem. I'm going to overthrow the government.
Mm.
The other term that's like really important if you're trying to understand natural resources is the term rent seeking.
Yes.
So related to corruption, oil encourages rent seeking. And that just means that a leader wants to increase his or her individual share of wealth, contributing to all the creation of more wealth overall. So for example, I build a new factory, others make money on me giving me a parking lot or a telecommunication company or providing security agents.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for the economy overall. But oil isn't like that in Africa.
That's
all
right.
It does is just give a leader oil money to play with and oil money that they can use to buy away problems without actually like fixing them. And for a student of democratic theory, I think it's really, this is more of a theoretical issue, but
yeah.
I think it replaces the need for taxes. So taxes are a very important basis of democracy and a sustainable economy. So everyone who complains about paying their taxes, I encourage you to remember for Americans every April 15th that without taxes, there is no democracy. And without democracy, they come part and parcel. You have to have taxes to have a good democracy. So if there's enough oil money flowing in, the state doesn't need your taxes. And if the state doesn't need your taxes, the state doesn't feel connected to you as a citizen or a voter because they can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no stake in improving the country because they have an independent way to get profit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why oil revenue really props up bad leaders like Obiang of Equatorial Guinea, Dos Santos of Angola, Gaddafi in Libya.
Yes.
They could stay in power because they don't need the pittance of tax money from their impoverished citizens. They can do what they want because of oil.
So oil, you're saying, disconnects the leaders from their people because we basically don't need you to keep our good thing going.
It totally removes democratic accountability. And So those are all pretty well-studied effects of oil. I notice, based on my research, because I focus a lot more on gender, mm-hmm. is that oil operations are always male-dominated, and so they always marginalized women from the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And if That's women true. Are not connected to the economy, they can't be connected to politics. So oil economies just marginalize women economically and politically because there's really not a role for women, you know, on an oil rig.
I think because it's so like physically taxing, and generally that sort of environment, women aren't necessarily invited or would want to be invited to such an isolated environment, just surrounded by a bunch of
right. women. And how would you reconcile that with childcare and farming responsibilities and things like that? Oil operations also, by definition, they separate men from their families, mm-hmm. and men separated from their kinship ties is very bad. It turns out not very well, because it leads to a lack of, let's say, a lack of accountability.
I see.
There's a good chance that men might behave badly if they're far away from anyone who knows them. When I was in Mozambique, my male teenage students in Mozambique would often leave school, like drop out of school to go work in the gold mines of South Africa, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hear these terrible stories of how predatory it was for those teenage boys to live alone among all these adult strange men, even. So it's not just the men behave badly towards women, it's that they behave badly towards weaker, younger men who also come to work there. So just bad things happen when it comes to oil operations, including it leads to just people leave social support and social fabric in their home communities that protect them and help provide them norms which dictate their behavior. So that's just something I've noticed.
When people mention oil, they usually always think, oh, the economy. But it seems as though, like, this oil curse, it breaks down so many aspects of society. You go from families to social structures to social ties, and then the political system obviously is usually a disaster in terms of democracy. So it's a widespread throughout a country. I'm thinking it's one of the reasons why certain countries are so dysfunctional. Oil broke down so many things.
Absolutely. And it's a bit of a vicious cycle. So if you're a weak state, you're more inclined to not use oil well, and mm-hmm. then once you're not using oil well, it really just solidifies all of this bad governance. So it's cyclical. Yeah, I think you're right.
So we've mentioned oil, and most people think Africa is so resource rich, oil, diamonds, all and on mm-hmm. and on.
Which it is.
At the end of the day, why is it still so poor?
The $1 million question.
Yes, the $1 million question.
Oh, the $1 million question. To get a much better answer than I could ever give you, I encourage everybody to spend an afternoon reading a book called The Bottom Billion.
The Bottom Billion.
The Bottom Billion, absolutely. In lieu of someone reading that far more comprehensive book. Why is Africa so poor? You could build an entire library on that question and not get a good answer. So what I'll just tell you is I will list all of the explanations I have heard over the years,
mm-hmm.
and you can just figure out what you want to keep, what you want to toss aside, and what you want to integrate with each other. One of the explanations is geographic.
Okay.
So historically, I'm a huge fan of Jared Diamond and Guns, Germs, and Steel and, mm-hmm. and an anthropological approach to studying history. So the geography explanation goes, I guess, a little bit like this. So the Sahara cut off sub-Saharan Africans from resource trading. So mm-hmm. Africans living below the Sahara were much more isolated from the Middle East and Asia and other benefits from living north of the Sahara.
Okay.
It cut them off in terms of like social networking and information sharing, technology sharing, and things like that with Europe and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't benefit from that knowledge. And then also, you know, Central Africa. So Democratic Republic of the Congo actually has the longest running conflict in all of Africa. They've had UN peacekeeping force there since like the 1950s or something.
That's quite a while.
So Central Africa is so dense of a jungle that it's incredibly hard to govern, and it basically functions as an island because nobody can get in there, and that makes it very, very isolated. If you've read Guns, Germs, and Steel, another geography explanation is that sub-Saharan Africa had very few animals that could naturally be domesticated, which put them at a disadvantage, whereas Europeans had wild pigs that they could easily domesticate and get all that protein and benefit from, and they could trade the pigs and things like that. Africa has a lot of landlocked communities and countries. And an economic reality is that landlocked countries are always typically more poor than countries with access to the sea so that they can trade and travel and things like that.
Makes a lot of
landlocked countries in Africa. I even read a really great theory about malaria and high death rates during colonial rule, because the countries that naturally had higher rates of malaria couldn't invest as much in those African colonies because they kept losing their colonial rulers. So they were less likely to build schools and less likely to build roads. And they just went in, pilfered, extracted without being able to leave anyone there to actually build local infrastructure because of malaria rates.
This
is just a random paper I read.
That's very interesting.
And as I we already talked about the paradox of plenty, which is like the way that natural resources undermine rule of law. And then anyone who's, I guess, studied, I guess, corruption in Africa, which is a big thing you have to study if you are interested in Nigeria, they argue that, that Africa is not poor. We've already talked about natural resource. It's poorly managed.
Okay, it's a good way of describing the situation on the ground.
Absolutely. Money meant for public goods gets stolen by individuals, and this has this corrosive effect in which it disincentivizes honest work and building businesses and all the organic things that create a strong economy and a strong democracy. And this corruption makes foreign countries not want to invest in your country. And then when they do, foreign countries that could be helping build up an economy often have to engage in corrupt practices even to function. And Yuval Noah Harari, who has the great book Homo Sapiens, which is, I think, a New York Times bestseller right now, he talks about the value of your credit, the credit rating of a country mattering much more than resources. So all of these problems are mutually constitutive, and and this corruption keeps credit ratings very low, which is a root problem in why Africans have a really hard time pulling themselves out of poverty. And I think it was Dos Santos who also makes the argument that if a big problem in Africa is that land is informally owned, and everybody just kind of agrees that this family's been here and they farm it, so it's their land, and it belongs to the tribe or the community, so it's there's not land deeds. And if people don't own their own land and businesses on paper, and they only own it informally or through traditional law, then they can't use that to put up collateral to take out loans from a bank to create new businesses. So a lack of formalized land titles is really bad for economies, and that it's a pervasive problem in Africa.
I hadn't thought about that. The need to have something as collateral to get a loan, to get a business started, to get the economy going.
It's why women own so few businesses and such little land in Africa, because they have particular problems with that. Then I think you're sure you've heard of the brain drain.
Yes,
that's a huge problem. And then the health outcomes and HIV and AIDS. So diseases and pandemics, they force kids to drop out of school to work. They kill breadwinners and families. Funerals are expensive. And so these health outcomes slowly use up savings and family resources, especially long-term treatment. And then also, have you ever heard of dependency theory?
Well, I'm assuming you depending on somebody, but give us a bit more detail about what that means.
It's pretty simple. It's basically that there's the argument that aid money and donations are bad for Africa.
See, a lot of people, when they hear that, that's shocking and stunning, because they see the commercials, they call in, they get the credit card, they feel like a good person for the rest of the day, and you're saying, do not give this money. That's a controversial statement to make.
Part of me buys into that. So here's the issue with dependency theory. Donations work like oil revenue. It's free money for a country that the country doesn't have to generate. And so there is the argument that if you donate enough money, what you do is you keep people just surviving, but not willing to oust a leader or overthrow a government. So you keep a country barely functioning, but not able to actually prosper and not able to actually grow an economy organically.
That sort of goes on the line of like, if I were to sort of like extrapolate, if we let them suffer just a little bit more, they may be able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And that's always a controversial argument to make, even in a well-functioning society.
It is super problematic. And there's just no winning. But there's also so many cases of aid money being used so badly. Food aid being stolen by rebels. And it goes badly if it's not very, very closely managed. So I don't know. I'm not a development specialist, so I don't know if the answer is less aid money.
Or better processes.
Or better processes for aid money. I'm just saying that there is dependency theory where people argue that just giving money to an economy is actually detrimental. And then I guess this is kind of a historical argument. I already mentioned about countries competing for the Western Hemisphere versus Africa. And you could also argue that Africa is still battles with poverty because, so the Spanish were already in the Western Hemisphere, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. and they were more investive in schools and churches and things like that. So then Africans were left with the European powers who were only extractive.
Okay.
And so that they don't have the structure today that they would have if they had been in the Western Hemisphere. And then actually the questions I get most about Africa have to do with war and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So war and conflict is obviously
a wealth destroyer.
Absolutely. It dampens business activities. It alienates customers from businesses. It kills family members who bring home income. And then African borders are so porous and Africans are so diasporic that wars tend to be contagious and they destabilize neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Like an example of this is Liberia in the 1990s. And I would also say that tribal conflicts are so deeply entrenched by European rulers that these conflicts still divide countries even today. So I would also add that the conflict is both a product of the poverty, but contributes to the poverty.
So all of those things that you listed, those were quite a lot. And so when people say, why is Africa so poor? They may think it's a single thing, but this is a conflagration of many things.
People write books and there's no answer. There's so many reasons. Yeah.
And the last one you ended with was talking about wars and conflicts. Mm-hmm. And when I said growing up, well, I only heard about Africa from the news or from some sort of National Geographic special. On the news, it was almost always something bad and horrible had happened. So the atrocities that have happened in the past few decades, that's always left me wondering, how could they have happened in so many countries in Africa, and what was the consequences? What were the effects of that?
So I guess I would hope that if anyone who'd been listening up until this point, that you realize all of the confluence of factors that lead to poverty and all the problems also would lead to conflict as well. Okay, so your question is, why does Africa have so many conflicts and what are the effects of them?
Yes, it does, okay. As of late, seem to be dominating in the amount of conflicts it has. Other parts of the world have problems, but Africa usually stands out.
Okay, if I can give a succinct answer. So I think the outcome of conflicts in Africa exists on a spectrum, and you have worst case scenario outcomes of a conflict and less worst outcomes. I don't want to say best, but certain positive aspects can come out of conflict. Okay. There can be positive effects of conflict. So worst case scenario would be, so after the West African civil wars of the 1990s, I'm thinking like specifically Sierra Leone, which started with its civil war in 1991, that's the worst case scenario. You have the entire breakdown of societies down to individual family units. And those are the conflicts that can often spread to neighboring countries. And this sort of a conflict is so destructive because you have family members killing family members. You have the conscription of child soldiers, which still happens in Central Africa.
Mm-hmm.
and and in this case, the near complete dissolution of the state, right? So if a family unit can't even keep together, how is a government going to keep functioning, right? And in my opinion, for a society to survive a major conflict, you need one of two things.
Okay.
A, you need a government that's strong enough to maintain some semblance of order that people can aspire to. And I would call that accountability through the state.
Okay.
Or B, you have kinship ties that people can fall back on when the state fails them.
Okay.
If you have one of those two things, accountability through the state or accountability through kinship, your country could be okay. You could make it through.
Okay.
So in the worst atrocities that I've studied, both of these are destroyed. You have to have a state that's non-functional and kinship ties that are non-functional. So in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, you see both of those failures. In the Sudan, you see both of those failures for different reasons. In the Sudan, it's more about economic realities separating families who are traditionally farmers. But those are two examples where both of those things failed, and that's why you have pervasive conflicts.
Okay.
And so in these cases, one of the things that I think we forget about is that the greatest shame doesn't necessarily always come in the fighting, but in the after effects, the tertiary effects. And these are things that you don't really read about on the news because the violence is what garners the headlines, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like as an example of the secondary effects of conflict in Africa that gets ignored is I read a couple articles on the proliferation of HIV and AIDS in the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
being based on conflict displacement. So many of the AIDS orphans who began to... So AIDS came about in the 1980s. Then you have AIDS orphans in the 1990s. A lot of those AIDS orphans constituted the child soldiers later on. And because they were orphans and they had no family ties,
mm-hmm.
it was very easy to get them to join the fighting.
Oh, I never made that connection.
Absolutely. I noticed in Mozambique that oftentimes conflict, it causes starvation. People are food scarce, and that leads to people hunting and eating wild animals and even poaching that they would never normally do, which is why, for example, Mozambique actually had one of the bloodiest civil wars in African history. And there's really a lack of wild animals and a lack of biodiversity because people ate everything because they were starving.
Wow.
So, and then obviously you have a rise in like sexual violence and things like that. So, but I, on a positive note,
yes,
there also
let's get,
is...
let's get some positivity there here.
There is a better case scenario. There are cases in which conflict can give countries a chance to rebuild. And the quintessential example of that is Rwanda.
Mm.
So you had the horrible Rwandan genocide in the spring of 1994. 850 million Tutsis, mostly Tutsis, were killed. And now, because like literally all the men were murdered,
mm-hmm.
Rwanda has the highest number of female parliamentarians of any country in the world.
Mm.
And as an aside, I'm not drawing a correlation. It also has comparably far lower rates of corruption.
Well, we don't want to
than any African country. I'm just going to point out that coincidence. I'm too good of a social scientist to draw a correlation, but I'm just pointing that out.
We can hope.
We can hope. We're going to excuse the fact that the president who took over after the genocide has been keeping power a little bit too long. Another example of good building after a terrible conflict,
mm-hmm.
is post-apartheid South Africa.
Yes.
Was the first country in the world to protect LGBT rights in the national constitution.
That was so surprising to me. You don't mm-hmm. think forward-thinking social rights in like an African country, but it happened and South Africa led the way. It's very impressive.
Ecuador also has a constitution that mentions the rights of gays and lesbians. So
it's usually America, Canada, Northern European countries,
yeah.
But it is possible in pockets of other countries where these things are happening.
South Africa, trailblazing.
There you go.
And with that, Ashik and I have realized that we are approaching an hour, so it's time for us to wrap up. Thank you very much for listening. I hope that we've discussed an issue or two about Africa that's been new or interesting for you. Again, this is Lane Munir, and you've joined me for my first ever podcast. Please feel free to share this episode with anyone who has either a passing or an enduring interest in Africa. If I record again, I'll be sure to post a link from my website, which is www.developingworldpolitics.com. Thank you very much again, and keep exploring.